There is nothing that is bad. So everything that is not bad. Bad would not be a quality of anything that exists. If we're going to have to talk about, you know, somehow the intrinsic quality of things, we assume and we can know that things don't have intrinsic qualities. Right from our very first session, we talked about an event is what it is, a thing, an object is what it is, and we invest it with qualities. Now, rather than seeing them as neutral, right, what I'm trying to get across is somehow we can see them all as good, everything is good, in the sense that it's not bad. We use judgments very frequently in order to help make these decisions about whether a thing is good or bad, etc. And what I would like to talk about is judgments. Just the whole nature of judging at all. Judgments are often subtle and try to pass for objective observation. Very frequently we'll be making a judgment and we're going to try to palm it off on ourselves and on others as an objective observation. But insofar as they are judgments, they will cause unhappiness. Some of the examples, can you think of certain judgments that kind of try to pass for observations? Oh, very simple things like...
Poverty is
bad. Excuse me?
Poverty is bad.
Yeah, yeah, but does that even try to pass as an observation? That sounds like a write-out judgment. It is bad.
Somebody said to me recently that my daughter was immature.
Okay.
So I said, that's a judgment. She said, no, that's a fact.
Yeah. Right, so now it depends. There are facts, right? Now one could say immature and mean it as not a judgment if you were referring to a biological fact. She's not ripe. She's not ripe. But there's a good chance that what a person means is that there's something not particularly good about that. Oh, to say CK is talkative. Don't you wonder why would that be pointed out if it wasn't some kind of a judgment? Right? Oh, well, I don't mean it as a put-down. It's not a put-down. But yet it isn't an objective observation, and yet it is an objective observation. If somebody's talking, they're talking. But to say that they're talkative implies some constant state of being, implies, you know, all kinds of things, and that there's something other to be, or there's something one could be. Why would that even be mentioned? There's something else you could be. Why would we go around saying people anything that would imply there's something else you could be if we weren't making the judgment that you're not good enough yet?
How often do people respond badly to what is really an observation? Because all throughout their life, when anyone says something, it's not an observation, it's really a
There's really
judgment.
A judgment behind it, right. Gee, you're tall.
Would you are angry be an observation or a judgment?
It could be both, right? All of these things that I'm saying could in themselves be observations, but almost always frequently, you know, almost always they're judgments trying to pass as observations.
You're very quiet.
You're fat.
You're fat, right. Exactly. Why would that, you know, unless you were a doctor somehow trying to tell somebody something that you didn't think they knew, you know, gee, you're tall, you're fat, you're short, you're very quiet. That observations often try to, you know, judgments often try to pass themselves as simple observations. Oh, I'm only stating a fact. The question, of course, will come up is why make an observation? Well, we can get to that later. Why even make an observation? We use judgments on the value of something. We make judgments on the value of things, you know, what we value them as, in order to make a decision. And that would be why you would make observations. In order to make a decision, we make judgment. In order to make a decision, we needn't have our frame of reference be good or bad. It doesn't have to be that kind of a judgment, good or bad. So again, what kind of judgment is being made if you're making the judgment on somebody, oh, that they're fat? Various people will mean different things by it. One of the judgments that might be made on somebody being fat is that that is bad. But another judgment may be, no, that that's not bad, but that it is better not to be fat. That may be more judgment. So there would still be some kind of a judgment probably involved. And the nature of the judgment is, I guess, what we want to look at. Very frequently by good and bad, what we're really talking about is our happiness. And that when we make judgments on things, on people especially, but on anything, we're probably saying things like, this thing is helpful versus destructive to my happiness. And that things are constantly being judged as whether they help for our happiness or they destroy our happiness or they prevent our happiness or something. And of course, the obvious middle judgment is that they have nothing to do with our happiness, which is what most people don't say. So we could improve on that because it leads to unhappiness, the judgment that it is helpful or destructive to my happiness, by having another system which is something like, well, it's not helpful to my happiness, or it is helpful to my happiness, or it's more helpful than something else. There isn't a negative implied there, a negative judgment, which then leads us to saying it's bad and feeling bad about its occurrence. We could just say it just isn't helpful. From where I'm at, it's not helpful for my happiness. That wouldn't be anything to feel bad about. To say that certain things are not helpful to our happiness don't make us feel bad, unless we believe they ought to be. Then if we believe they ought to be, we're not really saying that they're not helpful, we're saying that they're destructive, that the absence of them is destructive to our happiness, that it makes us unhappy. So if I believe there ought to be something here right now, and there isn't, I could say, it's not being here is not helpful to my happiness. But what I really mean is that it's preventing me. It's not being here is preventing me from being happy if I believe it ought to be here. Now, sometimes people find that in the absence of negative judgments, and this is another aspect of it which we can explore, that if you don't have negative judgments, if everything is either going to be helpful or more helpful, or irrelevant to our happiness, we are faced with the question that sounds something like this. If it doesn't make me unhappy, then why shouldn't I do it, or allow it, or cause it, or something, you know? So that a question would be like, say somebody might ask you for something, and it wouldn't make you unhappy to give it to them. That would be a simple fact, perhaps. You're not into making those kinds of feelings for yourself. You're not into making yourself feel bad. But very frequently what happens is, okay, I wouldn't be unhappy to give it to you, so therefore I should. It becomes very frequently the thing that happens, because if I don't have a negative reason for not doing something, then I must do it. And what really is taking place is that we're bypassing the whole question of our desires when we jump to, if I don't have a reason not to do it, then I should do it. Probably what took place, what had to take place to say that should, is that there was a desire to do it. But because we're so used to doing things and not doing things because they're bad, and using unhappiness as the rationale, that when the unhappiness is gone, we forget, in a way, that there are other reasons for doing things, that we may really have some reason for desiring it. So that you may ask me for $10. I would not be unhappy to give you $10. But I could play a game in myself which says, therefore, I should give you $10. The chances are that if I play that game in myself saying, I should give you $10, what I really have noticed is that there was a slight desire in me. There was some kind of a desire in me to do it for a reason, for the reason, for instance, that you thought it would make you happy. The reason is that, you know, you wanted it and that would make you happy and that would make me happy, and I had a reason for doing it. I would have a reason for saying, I therefore should do it. But we bypass that reason and it becomes totally ignored and we can't even decide on whether that reason is a good enough reason or not for us. Then we come up with guilt feelings. I should do it and I'm bad if I don't, because I'm not going to be unhappy without it. That's not right of me. And that doesn't only extend, of course, to giving money. It extends to lovemaking, to sex. It extends to sharing something. It extends to being honest. It wouldn't make me unhappy to be honest, so therefore I should be honest. And you have these people who let it all hang out everywhere. You know, those kind of feelings. That no matter what may happen, since I'm not going to be unhappy, then I should do it. And so perhaps we could discuss that. If we start making negative judgments, very frequently, for some reason, we find that shoulds start coming up, and that the things that no longer were negative. So, for instance, people may find that in sexual liberation, for instance, they struggle to be free of all of their should-nots. They struggle to be free of all of their ideas that sex is dirty and that it's wrong. All of which they try very hard to see as illogical, as nonsensical, as irrational, whatever. And they try to see, of course, it's not true, it's not true, it's not true, sex is not dirty, sex is not dirty, sex is not dirty. After struggling with that for a long time, they have tried to throw out every reason that might possibly prevent them from having sex if they wanted to. And what very frequently will be overlooked by a person who has strived so hard to overcome fear is the I want to part. So now they feel, I must have sex whenever there's no reason not to. That I ought to have sex because otherwise it'd be like saying it was dirty. It'd be like making up a phony reason for not having it, like I used to do. And so therefore, if someone wants to have sex, or if it occurs to me that I might want to have sex, I should therefore have it. Because if I don't have it, I'd be playing into my sex is dirty game. So that the only reason, see, we're forgetting that we believed that the only reason not to have sex was because it was dirty. That was the only reason we ever used because, well, once you have that, you don't need other reasons not to have it. Mm-hmm. That could suffice. Not that there wouldn't be lots and lots of other reasons for not having sex. But when the one predominant reason is taken away, we think, well, now there's no good reason anymore because that was the only reason that ever mattered. That was the only reason we ever used. Now such questions as disease, such questions as want to go to sleep instead, such questions as there's more or different things that I want in a relationship, you know, all of those somehow just can't be seen for the fear that there'll be a cop-out, that we'll be playing back into our own fear and using them as an excuse. What is being overlooked again is that perhaps, just perhaps, nothing ever has to be decided against. And that we do not have to make judgments ever against anything. That really what might be going on and what could be going on is that we will make judgments for things, for other things. And so that if a person is eating a meal and is finished and they feel satisfied and they've enjoyed the meal, someone says to them, would you like some dessert? Usually what happens, oh no, I couldn't, becomes the expression. Oh, it would make me sick. I couldn't eat another bite. All kinds of negative reasons have to come up against having the dessert. Rather than just simply, dessert would be nice, but I more want where I'm at now. And that there needn't be anything bad about having dessert. But I more want where I'm at now. And it can become a judgment for where we're at, a choice or a preference for what we're doing, than for making the change, rather than a choice against making the change. And that could follow with all kinds of things. One does not have to decide against chocolate ice cream in order to have vanilla ice cream. One does not have to decide against anything. So you don't even have to decide against sickness, because really, what's the decision? The decision is really for health. And if you look at it, you'll find that all negative decisions and all negative judgments are always secondary. They've always come second because somewhere there was a preference for something first, which we never used to feel free to express the desire for. When we were unhappy people, we always used negatives, so that now we'll use a negative as an expression again. But it doesn't really follow, and you'll find that you never really are deciding against anything. The only possible reason you ever could have to decide against anything is because you've already decided for something else. You would only decide against being uncomfortable Because somehow you've made the decision for being comfortable. After you've already decided for something, you are in effect pretending that you're deciding against something, as if you needed that additional reason in order to follow through with what you've decided for. You could fool yourself into thinking that you've been deciding against all of these other things, and then see yourself as somehow no good for yourself, as self-defeating. And now we have to come up with reasons. Why would, if I'm going to decide for something, then somehow I have to give a reason for deciding against the other thing. And if you notice, the reason is never going to be that I decided for this. It's got to be some other made-up reason. See, so if I decide for vanilla, I have to make up a reason for not wanting chocolate, which is I had it last week, or as if you had to explain why you didn't take chocolate to yourself or to anybody. Once we don't admit that we've decided already,
yes,
we have to find reasons for deciding against it. That's the way we really are making decisions. And that we're pretending that we're using
right.
negative reasons.
I was thinking of an example like reflex. I'm trying to see that as deciding for something hot touches my hand and deciding for continuation of my state of well-being or, you know, comfort. It just seems, I guess, so habitually simple to see that as an avoidance of the heat.
Yeah.
Or when an animal moves away from the light, we've always said he's moving away. Even Freud said the pleasure is the pursuit of avoiding pain.
Right.
Perhaps it's
how many people say
moving.
Happiness is that too, is the avoidance of unhappiness, and it strictly consists in trying to get away from unhappiness.
It does make a some sense with smaller animals, because when you put light on them and they don't like it, they rarely make a mistake where the dark is. They usually walk that way. Somehow move that way. Like with the planarias, they don't seem to make much random behavior. They seem.
I'm
to
not sure I'm talking about that though.
Do you think they're different?
I'm not sure I'm talking about avoidance behavior. I'm talking about negative decisions, decisions against things, are really decisions for something else. When there is a question of decision, I think some of what you're talking about may have nothing to do with decision. I'm not convinced that any animal other than man ever makes a decision as such. That, in other words, has value judgments and acts on those beliefs.
But you could
so we're
really
only talking about in a situation where a decision would be.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
see, they tell us, for instance, I think, that certain reflex actions completely avoid the brain. That they take place on another level, so that you touch hot and you withdraw. We are aware that there's an interlocking of the system, and that I could not withdraw if I wanted to. I could keep my hand on the flame. But there is a mechanism where my body will constantly try to return to its equilibrium and its health. And I think that what you're finding is a struggle to return, which certainly looks like avoidance. And so semantically, it's very convenient, I suppose, especially if you come from a negative environment, to describe it as avoidance. But why don't we just say that the hand is returning to the body? See, returning to a previous safe condition. When an animal faces a danger, it almost invariably turns and runs. It rarely, and the studies prove this, run forward in another direction and around where it was going. So for instance, if an animal's coming along and you're here, it will rarely try to scoot by you, rarely. It will almost always turn around and go back the other way to get away from you, to return to where it's been.
Oh, in the direction it came.
To return to where it's been, right. Mm.
But you could really say that whatever is happening, and that's objective. Then
yes.
When you want to explain it, you go into, it's possible to go into a judgment, and then
yeah.
In that judgment you can give it good or bad, but in actuality.
But then again, do you see, you have the problem, whatever happening is fine. But now, you very frequently call upon yourself to make something happen that isn't happening. And I think that's, you're talking about the one moment ahead in the future. Do you want chocolate or vanilla? You may call upon yourself to make one of those happen to you as opposed to the other.
Right.
So that, sure, there is a way of living which would just let one of them happen to you. But the chances are that you're going to call upon yourself to make a decision for one of them.
The judgment is chocolate is better, or I had blah, blah, blah last week.
But those factors, that judgment, was the causative agent that made the difference, made you go for the chocolate. See, that was the reason, the rationale, whatever you want to call it, that made the difference. Without that rationale, who's to say what you would have gone for? And I think you could transcend all of that and behave without reasons at all, whatsoever. Then there would be another rationale, but it would hardly be rational in the sense of intellectual. There would be a rationale which somehow the whole universe would be exerting upon you, the sense of well-being for you biologically in your scheme of things, you know, somehow perhaps. But there will be, it's an interesting thing, just to talk about causes is a very sticky problem. To imply that there's a cause for anything that preceded, you know, for anything that comes after something, that there was a cause that preceded it.
It's also conceivable that you do what you do.
And not because you do it, but
and not even because you're giving yourself a reason.
Yeah, you just do what you do.
And then you say, or before you say, well, I'm going to have it because, yeah. Or I took it because.
Yes.
But it's really just happening anyway.
What are the determinants that make it happen, though?
Who knows? I don't know.
Okay, well then, problem is, though, that we find that there is a pattern that people who consistently make things happen that they say they don't want to make happen have some kind of a rationale going on. And that there is a difference between the person's beliefs, between the kind of people who one thing happens with and another person who another thing happens with, so consistently that it would certainly seem that the belief is the factor, is the causative factor. So that without a certain belief, you wouldn't act a certain way. But with that belief, you can. Yeah, now for instance, to be angry. Every person who's angry, it's true, as Sheila say, anger may just happen. But why is it that anybody who I've ever seen who was angry for a reason? You see, so that true, maybe the reason was concocted in order to be angry, and just anger was what they were destined to be at that moment. But then how come somebody wouldn't make up a different reason other than that they were unhappy?
I came between the cat, the animal, the dog, and it's home. And the bird, it's home.
Okay.
It's home. It became very frightened and quickly ran around.
It's returning to where it was. Why was it afraid of you except that perhaps you were blocking its way to its home? So that, you know, if that was the causative factor, what it would try to return to was its home, it may not have been afraid that it was in danger from you, but just that you would prevent it from going home. I don't know. I don't know that we have to know. It doesn't sound inconsistent with the studies, but I'm, like I said, it only often happens. I'm not sure that it always happens. There's a lot about animal behavior that people don't know. But it would seem that this animal life, biological life, tends to try to return to where it knows it's safe, where it's been safe. That may, again, be an example of it trying to return, and it may, in some cases, even go toward you, if that's what it needs to do to return to its safety, when it's frightened, you know?
There's no way of knowing, of course, if it's making a judgment as far as what's safe.
No, nor do we care, right? Nor does it really make any difference to the way you make judgments. As to whether you're going to make judgments or not for your happiness.
I want to bring up something that happened to me last week and see if we can analyze it. I was on the subway and I was going toward, I was going to catch my bus after group last week. And we came into the station and they opened the doors and smoke started pouring in the car. And, well, my reaction was, there's smoke coming in. what am I going to do? I mean, I would like to avoid this smoke. And so I didn't use fear. I mean, I just looked around. All sorts of people started jumping off the train, running all around. And I didn't do that. And when I waited around for a few minutes and observed, I saw that the fire was in the station, and that if I stayed on the train, that I would probably have a better chance of getting away from the smoke than if I jumped out and ran. And that was also the conclusion of the conductor, who kept saying, "Okay, I'm closing the door. We're getting out of here." And the people who stayed on the train
you know, left the station and the smoke, and the people who were out there went in and got into the smoke. Now, how I was sort of analyzing that in terms of the making a decision or a judgment, as I made a judgment, I suppose, in saying that it would be better if I didn't have the smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And
or could you have just known that you weren't going to have the smoke?
Mm-hmm.
See, could that be a way?
I was aware that the smoke came from the station.
Yeah.
Because I just knew that. I mean, I
well, that would be the process later, to decide where the smoke came from, to observe.
Yeah.
That can all be done without judgment, to observe where the smoke came from, and to observe where there's no smoke. But you could start with a simple premise that sounds something like this. I will not have smoke in my lungs.
Yeah.
Without making a judgment. True, it may be based on previous judgments that it's not good to have smoke in your lungs or something, but at that moment, the conclusion to all previous judgments, or maybe no judgment at all, is just, I will not have smoke in my lungs. Not that it's better not to have smoke in your lungs, or it's better
well,
to, you
I don't
know,
remember doing any of that.
I'm not going to have smoke
no,
in my lungs.
No, you just decided not to
I
have
just,
the smoke.
Yeah, but I was thinking, what would the other people be doing, the ones that jumped up and ran out into the smoke?
They were deciding not to have it too, I suppose. But a lot of good at
but
them.
But they were using fear to motivate themselves.
Yeah, they were using the old thing, you know, not looking for a goal to move to.
But just running around madly and
something
you know,
to move away
from.
They
lit a fire
it.
Under
I
themselves
get away from and, here. What, whatever
it is. And wanted to get away from it.
Yeah, but you preceded this by saying we always do what we think is best.
Yeah.
Despite what we say we're doing.
Yeah, right.
So they were doing what they thought was best. And you were doing what you thought was best.
Which
so how come they went into the smoke, whereas she got out of the smoke?
Nonetheless, they did what they thought was best, and so very frequently we find that we
if
think we're doing what we thought was best, and we don't do what we really want best.
It might have been fear of being trapped in the subway car.
That was in case it was smoky.
Yeah.
There were all other kinds of decisions to make. Who's to say?
It was fear of smoke, and they didn't stop to determine where was the smoke coming from.
Sure, the old thing about a panic in a crowded theater. People become more afraid of the smoke and the fire than they do become of other people trampling them.
Yeah. When the Brooklyn Bridge was being built, guide wire that was supporting a boom that was hoisting a huge brick, or whatever you call it, a huge building stone, the guide wire broke. And the boom went crashing down. It was way up high, and it was hitting things, and everything fell down, you know, the boom, the wires, the stone, and a few men were killed. But after an investigation was made by the Roebling, who was building the bridge, he was always very careful about safety, and he made a careful investigation and found that every man that had died did so sheerly out of panic. If they had stayed or immediately surveyed the situation, they would have seen they were safe. Every one of them threw themselves into the path of what was happening. One man jumped over a huge brick and was crushed, and if he had just stayed alongside of the brick when the boom came down, he would have been protected by the brick.
Well, what happens with anybody who has a fear? Frequently rush headlong into that fear to undo it. The fear of death becomes much worse than death itself.
Oh, yeah.
The fear of there not being an end. Like, for instance, if you said, I always wanted to believe that there was an end. The fear of there not being an end might be much worse than there not being an end. And trying to somehow remove that fear.
So it's like problem solving.
You don't solve the problem with compulsive behavior, but with fear. No problems are ever really solved by fear. No personal, emotional problems. A lawyer friend told me that more people who are legally not guilty, whether they were, you know, actually guilty or not is not the point. More people who would never be found guilty by any judge or any jury still say that they're guilty. And they'll go to court and they'll, you know, plead guilt just to get it over with. That the fear of being sentenced, the fear of being found guilty, becomes so great, the trial drags on and it gets postponed and the witnesses aren't there and the defense lawyers and the prosecution, etc. It all drags on, and that the fear of ultimately, at the end of all of this, being found guilty then becomes so great that they say, look, plead guilty and get over it, I'll pay the fine, or plead guilty and I'll take 6 months, or, you know, etc. Plead guilty and get it over with is very frequently the phenomena for people who the lawyer in his own best judgment knows would never be found guilty, would probably have to be found guilty. And he said people who are not at all guilty, even in fact, in reality, it doesn't even, you know, that they were not guilty, that they just simply did not do the thing that they were accused of doing, would still plead guilty. And he gets these cases over and over and over again. Rather than face what happens, they will create what happens. It's very much like the child with the report card, or the guilty child. You know, they'll come home and they'll confess rather than live with all the fear of what'll happen if you eventually find out, and make the thing happen that might never have happened in the first place. The idea is to just, oh, please, I want to stop fearing it. The masturbator, the compulsive masturbator, compulsively masturbates just so he can get rid of the fear that he's going to masturbate. Because one of the things that happens after you masturbate is that you don't feel like masturbating again. And that is what's desired. What is not desired is to masturbate. The compulsive masturbator is not desiring to masturbate, but is desiring to be rid of the desire to masturbate. The best way to be rid of the desire to masturbate is to masturbate.
I had a twist on that. Does it really fit the kid that I was working with that would steal compulsively? Told me his reason for stealing was that he feels so bad when he realizes that he's stolen something. And what he meant by realizing is there's a period of forgetting in between. And then he punishes himself, and if he can feel bad enough, he'll stop stealing.
When he steals, he removes his desire to steal. That's what's happening in the first place. It's come from feeling horrible. I don't think that the feeling horrible is coming after. The reason the compulsive stealer or the compulsive masturbator masturbates is because they already believe it's so bad, that they've already made a pact with themselves. If I masturbate, I'm going to feel bad. Right? Okay. Then they have a desire to masturbate. And they remember, they've got this little treaty with themselves. If they masturbate, they're going to feel bad. Oh my God, I'm desiring to feel bad. I'm desiring to, I want, and which leads to the masturbating, because they've already gotten the idea that they're going to feel terrible for it. And they do. But almost always, the masturbator indulges in guilt. And the feeling that of guilt that comes after is almost a relief. I'm glad that I can feel guilty about it. I feel terribly guilty. But I'm glad that I feel guilty about it, and I don't want it anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's all over.
I can see.
So that there's a double-edged thing.
It's the last time I'll ever masturbate.
Now, very frequently, then, other magical behavior will be resorted to in order to supplant that. Remove the fear, that the fear becomes worse than the behavior itself, than the ultimate thing that we just feared. Now, for instance, for the compulsive masturbator, masturbation was a way of feeling good that applied very much to their problem, which might have been not feeling good, not feeling loved, not feeling deserving of any pleasure, you know. And for very frequently, for say a young teenage person just into puberty, they don't have a single moment of peace or happiness in their whole day except when they masturbate. It's the only moment of pleasure they ever know. Now, the fear becomes that that's all they're going to have. Well, that's the new thing.
Yeah.
Instead of masturbating, you take drugs,
right,
or booze. Believing. That's why it's forbidden to young people, because everybody knows they take it all the time. You know, you have to be 21 to drink. Because the way we treat young people, they'd be drinking all the time if we let them, if we didn't make it against the law. All right, so now, the person has found that they have made themselves feel good in spite of feeling bad. It becomes an escape from feeling bad. That in itself is something to be feared. That is why it becomes so feared.
It's feared because they think that's all they'll ever have.
Right, because they see why they're doing it. It's coming from unhappiness. Every compulsive masturbator, if no one ever told them that it was dirty, if no one ever told them that it was wrong, and usually don't, they would make it wrong. They would create it. Guilt only exists in our society because it exists in us as individuals. And it doesn't come from the society. That is not true. That is just simply a myth. Society does not place guilt upon us. We create it. Every time that we notice any behavior that comes from unhappiness, so anything that we've ever done or ever do that comes from unhappiness, that we do because we're unhappy, we feel guilty about. And so now, the person saw that this was a relief, something that they did from their unhappiness that felt good. They didn't want to feel good about feeling good this way. What they really wanted to do was to be a happier person. What they really wished, and every masturbator I've ever taken back his beliefs, said what I really wanted was to deal with what was making me unhappy. And if I masturbated, I would have no need to deal with what made me unhappy. If I could always make myself feel good this way, why should I deal with what made me unhappy? That was the fear. That if I did that, the fear was that I wouldn't then look. What always has helped them, of course, is if they could see that, hey, I guess I could masturbate as long as I didn't forget that I was unhappy. And as soon as that occurs to them, that it would be okay to masturbate and feel good then, as long as they didn't forget that they had problems, they immediately stopped feeling guilty about masturbating. And almost frequently, masturbation, you know, frequently diminished quite considerably.
Is guilt a should?
And when it was used much better. You know,
for them. It's a shouldn't.
Guilt is a should not.
I suppose, yeah.
If
I should not feel good this way. I should not feel good because it came from a bad feeling. Here, I'll try to explain it. Guilt is feeling bad about feeling good from feeling bad. We don't want feeling bad to lead to anything that feels good. We don't want bad feelings in us to lead to something productive or lead to something good. We don't want to encourage, we don't want to reward our bad feelings. Masturbation, in effect, becomes a reward for bad feelings and an escape from them, etc. And we don't want that, so we feel guilty about resorting to that. And you'll always notice that a person who is guilty will be very depriving of themselves in many ways. You know, the whole idea is to not enjoy yourself and feel guilty about every enjoyment, etc. Anything that may come from unhappiness.
Why would I want to reward my bad feelings and not feel guilty about it?
Oh, you would. That would be wonderful if you saw it that way. But the point is that people very frequently will fear that they won't deal with their bad feelings then, and they won't deal with what originally made them feel bad, and they won't make themselves feel better except by this, and it becomes an addiction.
So the more I
believe that alcohol is the only way that I'm going to feel good, right, the more I'm going to hate the fact that I drink. The more I hate the fact that I drink, the more I'm going to fear it. The more I fear it, the more I'm going to desire it, the more I'm going to drink. Nobody hates booze more than an alcoholic.
So I want to feel bad, not feeling good about feeling bad.
Exactly. I want to feel bad about feeling good, about feeling good.
And
it all becomes secret behavior. And of course, one of the big cesspool becomes sex. That's the thing everybody does behind three locked doors.
Three?
Or a door with three locks. Oh, nothing kills sex worse than somebody knocking on the door. Have you ever noticed that? People who supposedly think that sex is beautiful, sex is wonderful, sex is all kinds of great things. Somebody knocks on the door. Oh, yeah, sure. They really think that sex is good.
I'd like to see if I can apply this to a client of mine who has a compulsion every morning to stand at the train station and watch the pretty girls go by. Sometimes he'll make a derogatory remark, but it's like he's got to do this, and he feels terrible about himself for doing it.
Right.
Like somebody who has everything on the ball like him shouldn't have to do this, and yet he's doing it.
There, you said it.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have to do this. There should be another way for me to feel good.
Yeah.
I disapprove of the way that I'm taking to feel
yes.
good. Feeling bad about feeling good about feeling bad.
So if he could stop feeling bad that he goes to the train station, that would reduce the compulsion.
Then you could begin to look, for some reason you're doing this in order to feel good. What's so horrible about that? He's hoping that the worse he feels about it, the better he is, he'll stop. Why does he want to stop? What's he doing really that's so bad? You see? Why does he want to stop? Because he's recognizing that somehow he's doing that to feel good instead of what he really could be doing to feel good, which is to feel good. Well, the problem is that he insists on feeling bad about something in the first place. And rather than give up feeling bad about that, I'm going to resort to some other thing to feed myself, to make me feel good. Some other thing to nourish me, to whatever, you know, support my well-being, rather than give up my belief.
What is the problem he's trying to solve?
It makes him feel good to be derogatory toward pretty women. He doesn't like that he needs that. He doesn't like that he needs that, that makes him feel good. That makes me feel good. That's silly, that something like that should make me feel good. I don't want to know why that makes me feel good, for one thing, is very much a part of it. There's a bad reason why that makes me feel good, and I don't want to know why, but I do want to stop it. Very much like a masturbator. Again, keep using the example of a masturbator, and I think it becomes very clear, because the pleasure is much more directly obvious. Feels unhappy. Takes his penis into his hand and starts moving it around. And starts touching it, and somehow something as silly as that makes him feel good. It doesn't make sense. It's not right. It shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't have such an easy out. I mean, it just, you know, and I don't want to know why that makes me feel good. I just don't want to know why. But I want it to stop. Why don't I want to know why? Because if I knew why, I would be in touch with a belief. Something that I'm believing that I don't want to stop believing.
Mm-hmm. That I have to believe.
Something that I have to believe in order to be happy. And I don't want to, for instance, that women are bad. Maybe. Or that pretty women are only out to hurt you. And I can't stop believing that, because if I stop believing that, what protection will I have? And so I don't want to know why I get a kick out of doing this. There's no mystery about feeling bad. It's impossible to feel bad without knowing why. That's the whole difference with option, where the only ones that don't take I don't know as an answer. And everybody else will kind of go for that and buy that. Yeah, you don't know, you need help.
Poor thing.
And we'll work at it until you can know, you know.
What do you do when people say I don't know?
A couple of things like, why don't you know? Why don't you know? What are you afraid of knowing? Or what would you be afraid of if you knew?
There's a reason you wanted to believe you didn't know, what might it be?
Right. I have a patient who consistently says, I don't know. I sit, I count to three, and he tells me. Never more than three. I don't know. I don't know. No. Oh, you silence first. Always silence. Mm-hmm. Then if a person is stuck, well, my technique, there, you know, and I guess maybe you get the sense of it, there's probably a rule here somewhere. My technique is first silence. I keep repeating the question. They really stuck on it. I ask the opposite. Well, what would you be afraid of if certain thing happened? Because the I don't know comes to, why do you believe that that's bad, or why would you be unhappy about that, right? That's where the I don't know is coming from. I say, why would you be unhappy about that? I don't know. I don't know. Number of questions. Well, if you haven't got any reason to be unhappy about it, do you have to be? The other one is, yeah, but I don't know what. So then I say, right, what are you afraid would happen if you weren't unhappy about it? So that's another way to get through an I don't know. You wait for an answer. If none is coming, you say, okay, what would you be afraid of happening if you weren't unhappy about it? Very frequently that gets the answer. Simple things like I used to do, but I find that that's really a more effective question, was, well, what if you did know? What would it be? That surprisingly works.
It does.
You know? Or what are you most afraid of it being? You know, what are you most afraid of the reason being? And that, of course, would have to be the reason. What would you be afraid of if you knew? Well, then if I knew, I'd have to give it up. Why do you believe you'd have to give it up if you knew?
Which
is most important for a compulsive. Why do you believe that if you knew why you were making yourself unhappy, that you'd have to give up that belief that you feel is protecting you before you have something else to take its place that you feel would protect you? Why would you believe you'd give it up while you still believed it was necessary to have? Well, because it's silly and irrational. Be it silly or irrational, you feel you need it. Why do you believe you would, you know, go about giving it up? Would you have to give it up if you told me what it was? No, I wouldn't have to. Okay, well, how do you feel about telling me? You know, and then just work with that. You work with that as if that were the problem anyway. And each thing that comes up, you work with it, and it's just another thing to be unhappy about until you deal with that. And everything that stands in the way of their therapy just becomes another thing that they're unhappy about that you deal with, as that, like you would anything else. You have the person who's kind of, I don't know why I'm unhappy, I don't know why I'm unhappy, I just don't feel right, it's something, you know. And what they're constantly afraid of doing is making a decision, even about what is it that makes them unhappy.
Maybe I'm going to pick the wrong reason.
Right, exactly. And they're constantly afraid of being wrong. Yeah. They're constantly afraid of being wrong.
And they list three reasons every time you ask them a question, A, B, and C.
Right. What do you do with that? Think about it. What might you do with that? What's the fear? They're really afraid of being wrong. Why are you afraid of being wrong, you say? If I give the wrong reason, I won't get help. Well, can't you follow that? And what are you afraid would happen if you didn't get help? See, because what it really boils down to, Mandy, in an anxiety neurosis is a person who believes that they can't be helped. They certainly can't help themselves, and they haven't got the slightest idea who can help them, And they've got to cooperate with you to the utmost, and now they're so afraid of misleading you in the time. Had a patient come in. He thought of a session, six sessions back. He was really, really doing well, really very happy. Scared shit that he had lied to me, that he had said something that wasn't true, that may have invalidated all the happiness he's felt in the last 5 weeks. And came in frightened and angry at me, for really angry at me, and so scared that I might have even believed him. Angry at me that I wouldn't have discerned the difference.
The lie.
Yeah. And it was this. In this case, it was that the desire for affection comes before the desire for sex. And that mobilizes my desire for sex. And all of a sudden, 6 weeks later, it occurred to him, no, it's not the desire for affection that comes first. It's the desire for sex that came first, and then I want the affection. And he couldn't wait, and he was miserable to get back to tell me that that was might invalidate everything.
I'm so scared.
Right, and then the important question is, well, if for some reason or another I'm not able to help you, why do you believe you can't help you? Why do you believe you need help? I don't know. And then you're off again, you know. Oh yeah, because there are many patients where it really becomes very clear you do work with why are you here and, you know, why do you believe you need help? And what if you don't get what you're looking for? Okay, so the major point that I wanted to make was the way we use judgments, and that we use judgments, and that frequently we fool ourselves into thinking we're deciding against, and we can be much freer and much more happy if we realize that there really is no such thing as deciding against. That's an afterthought. That really what's happening is that we're deciding for something, and that's good. It doesn't have to be defended, doesn't have to be justified. That we're deciding for something. And that is good. And that all the things that, because we've decided for that, yes, but in effect, you know, we haven't only decided against one, we've decided against the whole infinite universe of things when we decide for one thing. And who wants to be in that position? I assure you, when I make a decision, I'm not deciding against the whole universe because I'm deciding for one thing. And why need I see myself that way? As deciding against everything because I've chosen this. And so very frequently we lead patterns like that. So for instance, how often have we then have to live up to our decision against? For instance, if I say, I don't want chocolate because it's too sweet, I can never have chocolate again. Because it's going to always be too sweet if it's the same chocolate, you know, somehow. And no, I don't want to lend you $10, you know. Or really, I want to keep my $10 is the decision. Somehow it's implied. No, but somehow it's implied I could never lend it to you again. You could never ask me again. I have a reason for not giving it to you. I have a reason for not giving it to you now that will always be a reason for not giving it to you, you know, which is not true. There may be a reason for keeping it. There may not always be a reason for keeping it. Human fear? Yeah, we'd be choosing for the safety that we knew. In a sense that we'd still be choosing for. And that's certainly a pattern with a rigid person. No matter how unhappy they are, at least they and they always say it, at least it's familiar. You know, maybe I'm unhappy now, but... You know, there could be
worse.
At least
I'm not afraid.
Yeah, and so there's a choice for, I think, always. It's just only a way of seeing it. It's just almost by definition, if you think about it. You can't be choosing against something unless for some reason you've had something in favor of its opposite, maybe. Or, you know, or something else that came first. There was another principle operating. Rather than, you hate this, you dislike that. There's something else you like better. And that's why you were able to make that comparison and that judgment.